The Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute mini-series. LDL cholesterol, lower, earlier, longer.
Hello, I'm Anita Sharma, a GP based in Brisbane in Queensland. Cardiovascular disease is a leading cause of death and morbidity in Australia. There is very clear evidence that a person's risk of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, including stroke, increases as LDL cholesterol increases. Around 80% of CVD events are preventable through early detection of risk and appropriate treatment. And GPs are central to implementing CVD risk assessment and management, as almost 90% of people in Australia do consult GPs in any year. However, evidence points to great practice gaps in the management of people with CVD in general practice. Many patients at risk of CVD are flying under the radar, and those with CVD are not achieving target levels. To help us understand better on how to bridge the gap in lipid management, we have with us today Associate Professor Adam Nelson, an interventional and general cardiologist from the Royal Adelaide and Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Adelaide, South Australia. Welcome, Dr. Nelson.
Amelia, thanks so much for having me.
So, we know that CVD in Australia could be significantly reduced by identifying and recalling patients for a CVD risk assessment using our new updated Australian CVD risk calculator. Australia's current guidelines for CVD prevention recommend risk assessment for the general population aged 45 to 74. However, given that GPs are time pressured while dealing with competing medical priorities, which patients should have this risk assessment? For example, does a woman who is 40 years old and appears to be otherwise healthy need a CVD risk assessment?
The bottom line is that anyone really can have a discussion around their cardiovascular risk. We all have a cardiovascular risk, and understanding those numbers is critical. The way the guidelines currently read, as you've just pointed out, those aged between 45 and 79 now have an opportunity to have a reimbursed opportunity for a cardiovascular health check. So that represents sort of the sweet spot at the moment. But we also know patients who have a precocious risk for coronary disease can be risk assessed earlier.
That's great. There has recently been a pilot study in primary care evaluating an SMS recall system called Heart Health SMS. Can you tell us more about this study and inform us on what we could learn from it?
We have done some work with the Heart Foundation using a integrated program within existing electronic medical record software whereby individuals who meet these parameters, age 45 to 74, those without established cardiovascular disease, and those who haven't had the heart health encounter already could be identified. And they were randomized to receive a recall or not. And what we showed, there's a lot more to unpack here, but that there was a 13 to 14 times a higher rate of those attending for a heart health check if you received an SMS compared to those who didn't. This idea that if we put this front and foremost amongst our patients' minds, they're more likely to want to attend. And I think it speaks again to your comment too, Anita, that if we're trying to squeeze this in around other conditions, other things that patients would see their GPs for, it becomes relegated. Now, I think that part of this whole movement needs to be establishing the need to assess cardiovascular risk part and parcel. I mean, we have the Glenn McGrath pink tests for breast cancer, but really heart health remains just as important for our patients.
So true. Can you provide us more detail on when lipid-modifying treatment should be considered for someone who does not yet have established CVD, or in other words, for primary prevention?
Anita, that's a podcast in and of itself.
I know.
But it's an important structure to really conceive how we try and discuss this with patients, because I think the challenge is an understanding of risk is a really abstract concept. For most, even clinicians, it's abstract, but for our patients, even more so. The way the Australian guidelines have been set up is that there is an arbitrary figure that has been put forward that if patients sit in the high-level category, that's a 10% five-year risk of an adverse cardiovascular event, or to be considered in patients who have got an intermediate risk, that the patients should be considered for lipid and or blood pressure lowering therapies. And the reason is because we think that at that point, somewhere between a 20 and 30% lowering of risk allows the number needed to treat for the individual patient to be reasonable. The difficulty there, Anita, is that what's considered reasonable for one patient will be different for Tom, Dick and Harry. And so I think one of the strengths and weaknesses of a guideline like this is that it's just a guideline, it's not gospel. But the bottom line is that if we explain to patients what their projected risk might be and then using the calculator and the pictogram that shows 100 participants of a similar age and sex and shows what the risk reduction could look like for that individual patient, then you get an assessment then of absolute benefit. And, you know, Anita, I've got patients in my clinic who I can take from a risk of 20% down to 15 or 16%, and they're not particularly excited about it. And yet I can have other patients who are so motivated to do everything they can do to reduce their heart health risk, and I take them from 5% to 4%, and they're happy with those very marginal gains. So I think it comes down to a discussion around absolute risk, and the way that the calculator does that is to provide these thresholds.
Absolutely. So let's say a new patient with a prior diagnosis of ischemic heart disease and recent hospitalization for a myocardial infarction comes in and states that he is taking his lipid-lowering medication as prescribed. However, we do know that even in those patients taking their medications religiously, almost half of patients with established cardiovascular disease are not achieving target lipid levels. And given that he is at very high risk for future events, this visit may be a good opportunity to assess whether his current lipid management is optimal. So this scenario is obviously representing a secondary prevention case. What LDL cholesterol target should we be aiming for in this patient?
Anita, we have a plethora of data to support an approach that is lower, longer, and earlier levels of low LDL cholesterol. And I think when we translate that to the guidelines, very clearly that it suggests that patients with highest absolute risk ought to have the most intensive regimens with the lowest LDL treatment targets. So in this case, really the guidelines, when we look mainly to the European and the American College, because ours are somewhat out of date now, to achieve an LDL of 1.4 or less. And I think the challenge here, Anita, is that patients don't feel any different whether they've got an LDL of 2.5 or 1.4. And so incumbent on us as a specialist, but also with our GP specialist colleagues in the community, is to explain to patients what these numbers mean. So, you know, in my clinic, patients aren't pot plants. I want them to know what their numbers are, and I want them to know why we're focusing on them. And so I explain to them that we've got LDL, which is sticky cholesterol, ends up in the arteries of the heart. That's what we've just spent our time opening up with a stent. But if we don't address the cholesterol up front, if we don't address these risk factors, we've emptied the bath and left the tap on. And so that's what I talk to my patients about. So for me, it's about a 50% lowering from baseline, number one. And number two is to achieve a goal of 1.4 millimoles or less. And if we get below that, that's fantastic. Really good data that linear relationship continues even to a level of 0.5 millimoles per litre. And perhaps if I've got a moment to say as well, Anita, that we don't see any real safety signal around low LDL. I think we've historically been concerned, is there too low LDL cholesterol? When, you know, we've got good data now from open label extension of PCSK9 inhibitor trials that there is no change in cognitive function. We don't see any change in adverse event profile. And really, we've got Mendelian randomization data to show patients who've got a large exposure, a lifetime exposure to low levels of LDL, have got longevity and resilience from cardiovascular disease. So for me, lower is better, and there's a degree of urgency around that too.
Yes, no, I think that's come out very clearly in what you've just said. And it's reassuring to know that the lower the better, there's no risk. But I love your slogan, lower, longer and earlier. That's really brilliant. Now, you have emphasized that it's important to make sure patients are reaching their lipid targets, which is appropriate to their level of risk. Now, in order to treat to target, once a patient commences lipid-lowering treatment, how often should lipids be measured?
One thing we've seen quite clearly, Anita, and you've mentioned earlier on, that very few patients achieve their LDL treatment targets. And as we've moved with the guidelines to iteratively lower levels of LDL, we've left a lot of patients behind. Our original guidelines, you know, we go back 30 years, an LDL target of 3.5, you know, and now we have 1.8 and now 1.4 millimoles per liter. We continue to move these goalposts. And so a number of patients who weren't reaching 2.5 are clearly not reaching 1.8, and they're certainly not reaching 1.4. So around about 1 in 5 overall at the moment are reaching their targets. And that's not because we've got difficult patients or uneducated doctors. It's multiple and varied the reasons why patients don't reach goal. But part of it's the fact that we don't attack it in a way that is emblematic of the urgency that we need. So, you know, we've seen from studies of intravascular imaging programs where we can achieve low levels of LDL cholesterol within weeks of an ACS, an acute coronary syndrome, and we can almost turn off plaque. We can thicken their fibrous cap, we reduce their lipid arc, we take a vulnerable plaque and make it inert. And so really, again, I show patients this. I show them the diagram, I show what lipid-rich plaque looks like, and I show them where the end game's going to be. So back to your question, that in hospital, we need to message that to our patients. At the moment, patients come back from the cath lab, they've got a tiny little band-aid on their wrist, They feel very well. They discharge with a length of stay of 1.5 to 3 days in general. That looks very different to what it looked like 30 years ago. Patients were in for 6 weeks, so given propranolol and prayer, and we'd see how they go. So this notion that we've got 2 days to pack into them all of this education means that so much of this, they come out to clinic with like a deer in headlights. And so we've got a lot of work to do to educate our patients about that and the urgency with which we need to do.
Good point. So we've discussed treatment goals for lipid management. Is there a role for combination therapies? And are there any other newer therapies that we should know about?
We have very good data for 30 to 40 years that statins remain one of the most effective ways to reduce LDL cholesterol, and they're now cheap as chips, even on a private script. And we divide statin intensity by low, intermediate, and high. And so our high-intensity statins are those of 12 or 40 to 80 milligrams daily, and rosuvastatin 20 to 40 milligrams daily. And we expect that with those regimens that patients will reduce their LDL cholesterol by around about 50%. We know that in trials of ezetimibe monotherapy on top of statins that we'll achieve an additional 15 to 20% lowering of LDL from baseline. And we have good data from Fourier and Odyssey trials of the monoclonal antibodies of PCSK9 that we can reduce LDL on top of ezetimibe and a statin of around about 50%. So if you add all those things up, Anita, we can reduce LDL cholesterol by about 80% with combination therapy, all three agents. So really what I think is important is that we understand where patients start. So if patients are starting with an LDL of 4, 50% reduction with a statin is going to get you to 2, an additional 20% reduction is going to get you to about 1.8. We're still a long way from being at 1.4 millimoles per litre. So I often talk to patients and say that. I say, look, this is where we're starting. We're starting at 4 millimoles per litre. We need to get you to 1.4. We know we're going to need to have at least 2 drugs on board and maybe in an injectable. And that's an important message for patients because suddenly they don't feel like they come into your clinic in 6 weeks and they feel like they've failed. You know, they've tried their best diet, they've tried their best exercise, but we know that so much of the handling of cholesterol is genetically driven and it's not oral consumption. Around about 15 to 20% improvements with diet is what you can achieve at the best attempts. And so we need to make sure we're not setting our patients up to fail, that this is very much a condition that needs to be managed with medications. And sure, diet's important for cardiovascular health overall, prevention of diabetes, et cetera. But from a cholesterol lowering point of view, the majority of our patients are going to end up on therapy and most of them are going to be multi-drug.
Yes. I know. I like the way you set the scene. You educate the patient about what's to come so they're prepared. And you're right. If you haven't set the scene and given them this information prior, when you start adding therapies or increasing doses and adding injectables, they're kind of overwhelmed and disappointed and like take it as they have failed. So, Dr. Nelson, you mentioned PCSK9 inhibitors. So what are the criteria where GPs can actually initiate these drugs?
Anita, we've had this challenge in the past where we have a discordance between what the evidence tells us and what the reimbursement allows us to offer our patients. That changed last year when the threshold for commencing a PCSK9 monoclonal like evolocumab or alirocumab was reduced from 2.6 to 1.8 millimoles per litre. But I think the most important change last year, Anita, was that it recognised that so much of lipid management occurs in primary care, and yet we were requiring cardiologists to initiate these medications. The change now allows that GPs, in consultation with a cardiologist, to commence these agents. And in consultation, in my mind, is a broad church. That, for me, is a phone call discussion. It's a shared care arrangement, potentially. It is an asynchronous clinic appointment. I think there are ways that we can interpret that I think is still within the ethos of the reimbursement. But the bottom line is that we want to support you to have the keys to start the engine to get these drugs on board. And, you know, I think when that comes from the GP, that the GP is interested in aggressively managing LDL, that for me is an important message to our patients.
Right. And for GPs to initiate that in consultation, the patient should have been on a background therapy of statin and ezetimibe at least for 12 weeks. Is that correct?
That's exactly right, Anita. I should have said, so patients should be on maximally tolerated statin. And what that means is that ideally that be a 12 or 40 to 80 or a server 20 to 40. But if you've got patients who've got muscle aches at a 12 or 20, then they go back to a 12 or 10 and they're okay. That's their maximally tolerated statin. In addition to ezetimibe, stable dose for at least 3 months with a recent LDL on that therapy, that then allows them to consider qualification for evolocumab.
So while we work in exciting times with many more drugs as options, time is often the biggest limiting factor in primary care, and GPs often have to juggle a myriad of conditions without sufficient time to focus adequately on CVD risk assessment and lipid management. Do you have any tips on how GPs can better deliver lipid management in this environment?
Well, you know, Anita, we need to do much better about how we communicate. You know, just do the needful is unhelpful. You know, as in, what would you like me to do in 4 to 6 weeks? Do you want me to push the Atorva from 40 to 80 or add in ezetimibe? When do you want me to consider the piece? So we need to be better and more prescriptive. And I guess we also need to start to bridge those gaps around communication. You know, we're often, it's difficult to pick up a phone because when you phone me, I'm in clinic. When I phone you, you're in clinic. So we need to work out ways that we can help support our patients in this journey, because it's both a marathon and a sprint. It's a sprint in hospital, but it's also a marathon.
I have definitely learned a lot from you today, and I'm sure all the GPs listening in feel the same. Could you summarize the key messages for our GPs to take from the discussion today?
Anita, I'd say a few things. First, to say that we now have a risk calculator that is much more fit for purpose for our Australian population. We need to use every opportunity to have a risk discussion with our patients when they present or where opportunities arise, but particularly the sweet spot around patients aged 45 to 79 for which the calculator has been designed and for which we can consider doing recall systems where we currently do that for mammograms and other preventative health conditions. The second thing I'd say is that guidelines are guidelines and they're not gospel. And so managing individual risk factors, particularly when we've got them elevated to high degrees, so systolic blood pressures north of 160 and LDL more than 5 should make you consider familial hypercholesterolemia. So individual risk factors remain important, but an absolute cardiovascular risk assessment is the way in which we can understand the potential benefits of lipid and blood pressure lowering therapies. The third thing I'd add to that is that an attempt to try and explain to patients what risk means. Risk is such an abstract concept. And so I think the use of the guideline online is a very helpful way to help understand that and to convey those messages to our patients. And then the last thing to say is that LDL lowering, the mantra remains lower, earlier, and ideally for longer. And when we apply that from an absolute risk point of view, patients at the greatest absolute risk derive the most absolute benefit with the same proportionate risk reduction. So what I mean by that is that 30% lowering from 20% is going to give you absolutely more benefit than someone who's at absolute risk of 5%, for example. And so that discussion allows, you know, where the intensity of lowering needs to be. So I guess the other mantra here is that, you know, these chats that we're having today, you know, I think it's so important to have better engagement between primary and tertiary care environments.
Dr. Nelson, thank you for those very excellent clinical takeaway messages.
Before prescribing the treatments discussed, please review the full product information. The substantiating references can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute in collaboration with Novartis and produced in March 2024.